This episode of the Tabletop Submarine Podcast is produced by Cake Pie Games. Cake Pie Games, games that are a piece of cake to set up and easy as pie to teach.
Welcome to the Tabletop Submarine, where we dive a little bit deeper into why we love board games. Strap in and prepare for a deep sea adventure. Here are your hosts.
Voyagers and people of Earth, people of Pluto, people of space, people who enjoy ray guns and people who enjoy rocket ships, it is I, Josh, your host of the Tabletop Submarine Podcast. With me is my number one co-host and host.
I'm Andrew, and today we have a very special guest. It is Scott Rogers, who is a genius of game design. And I say that because I like his stuff, but also because he teaches master classes in this. He's also an author of, I don't even know how many books. He's an ex-Imagineer from Disney, which is impressive if he didn't do anything else. Scott Rogers, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, guys. It's nice to be here in the submarine.
Yes, it's quite cramped, but it is quite cozy because we have pillows. In case you don't know, it runs off Code Red Mountain Dew and a nuclear engine. So everything runs. No, there's no chance of sinking. But yes, Scott Rogers, one of the people who very early on in my game design journey, I got introduced to through a documentary called The Game Masters. Mm-hmm. Documentary I still watch today sometimes, actually, because it's just cool to have on the background here all these experts talking about the game industry. But for people who may not know who you are, Scott, who are you and what do you do in this industry? What have you done?
Gosh. Well, I am a 30-year veteran of being a professional game designer in both the video game and tabletop space. A lot of people might know me, or at least know a lot of the games that I created in the video game industry, what are known as AAA titles. These are things like the original God of War, Pac-Man World, the Maximo series, Darksiders, Soul Calibur, or Soul Blade, actually, the original title, as well as titles like SpongeBob SquarePants and Bratz and Warhammer and things like that. So I worked on a lot of video games as a game designer and then later as a creative manager for the publisher THQ. The video game companies I worked for included Namco, Sony, Capcom, people like that. So I'm used to working on kind of big titles, mass market titles, you know, things that, were big, exciting video games. But my true love has always been board games. I go very far back with board games. Some of my earliest memories are playing board games. And in 2015, I created a board game, which eventually got kickstarted by IDW, called Ray Guns and Rocket Ships. And then since then, I've been making maybe almost once a year what are essentially mass market board games. So some of the titles that I worked on were Pantone the Game, which is a party game, The Alien, Fate of the Nostromo, which is a horror cooperative game. And the most recent one is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre game, from my friends at Trick or Treat Studios. And then, like you guys mentioned in the prologue, I've written some books on game design. The most well-known is called Level Up, The Guide to Great Video Game Design. But I have two others in what I jokingly call the exclamation point trilogy, which is Swipe This, which is a book about touchscreen game design, you know, games for mobile devices and things like that. And then the third one is a new book that just came out, called Your Turn, The Guide to Great Tabletop Game Design. And I'm particularly proud of Your Turn because not only is it a book about video game history and a book of video game mechanics and a book of video game theory, tabletop theory, like many other books that are out on the market, but it's also a workshop book in which you design six original board games by the end of it. And so if you are interested in all at being a tabletop game designer, whether you're a newbie or a professional, I think that Your Turn is a really good book that you should check out. It's available, you know, everywhere books are sold, Amazon and Barnes and Noble and places like that.
I concur with the statement. Yes.
I mean, talk about a resume, yeah. though.
Like, oh yeah, and Disney Imagineering too. I forgot. I did that too. And I teach occasionally, yeah, like USC and a few other places. So,
I mean, everything from, you know, freelancing board games all the way to what I consider almost the pinnacle of creative outlets, which is Disney Imagineering. Like, I could ask a million questions, but I want to try to ask one that narrows it down. What steps have you taken in your life to, you know, have such a creative focused career?
So in about 1996 or 97, I had an epiphany. And the epiphany was that everything I had done as a child was leading up to a career in game design. I just didn't know it. So as a small child, this is funny because I have something, Josh, that I call a geekyology, which is like a genealogy, but for nerdy stuff. And so I've tracked, like, you know, what are the things that I was interested in as a child? And where did it lead to me today? So, very early on, I remember playing board games. Like, one of my earliest memories is playing a board game called Green Ghost. And I talk about this in your turn. As kind of the highlights were, played a lot of board games and then video games as a child, because I grew up with video games. Like, my life is kind of the history of arcade and video games. I remember playing Pong when it first came out. I remember when the Atari 2600 came out. I remember Donkey Kong in the arcade, et cetera, right? So I have all these kind of milestones of when video games came out. I was there experiencing it, which is also one of my superpowers when I teach, is I can put everything in personal context and go, hey, this is my personal experience of, you know, when these things came out. When I was in high school, I worked for a board game store called The Gamekeeper. And my boss gave me the task of, he's like, look, I want you to be able to sell all these games. So you're going to take a game home every night and learn how to play it. So that way, when you learn how to play it, you'll be able to sell it better. So I did this I worked there for like a year. So and this was the time when this took place was, we sold, you know, historical games like chess and Go and backgammon, you know, very high end, like jewel encrusted sets of games. But we also sold mass market stuff. So Milton Bradley and Parker Brothers, you know, all the classics. But then this was the mid 80s. So it was right when the Game Master series came out. So Axis and Allies, Shogun, Broadsides and Boarding Party, like all those big box plastic games. And then the other thing that was just came out was Games Workshop games. So Talisman, Chainsaw Warrior, Blood Bowl, you know, all those games, Space Hulk eventually, all those games were coming out as well. So I literally, like, was there at kind of the dawn of Ameritrash games. Mm-hmm. I call it Ameritrash. Some people have a problem with that term, but, you know, I think it's still a funny term, so I like using it. So it was kind of that first big bump where, like, that's really where the hobby game market became mass. Because previous to that, it was a lot of war games, you know, all the things with chits, yep. You know, lots of those type of games. Yeah, Andrew's shaking his head. He's like, yeah, I played all those games as well. But I was never a big fan of war. Like, I played, like, Starship Troopers and a few others, but there weren't a lot of games that I felt were thematically very interesting to me. Mm-hmm. But then when all these mass market games came out about dungeon, you know, kind of Dungeons and Dragons-y type things and space and, you know, Star Wars-y adjacent type things. That's when I got interested, right? So I was like, wow, I started buying these games. So I wasn't just selling them. I was using my paycheck to pay for, you know, the latest Game Workshop game or whatever. So that was a big moment for me. And then I also discovered Dungeons and Dragons very young. I started playing in 1978. So that's about 5 years after the invention of the game. And so I was fortunate enough to kind of get on the bandwagon early, and I DM'd. And that's another big moment for me, was learning how to create an experience for other people, like how to learn how to make a game play for other people. So, and then of course, over time, I kept playing arcade games. I had roommates in college with computers and very deep catalogs of pirated games. So I would play a lot of games from them. So I was always playing games, video games, board games, role-playing games. I was always doing something game-related, but I was never making them, except for one summer. My parents lived in a house that was very high up on a hill, so it was, and I couldn't drive, so it was very hard for me to. I was essentially like a little prisoner in my parents' home, and I was like in junior high, and I spent the entire summer just making board games. I got bit by the bug, and I made like, I don't know, like about 8 or 9 different games, unfortunately, all of which have been lost to the sands of time. So that was another thing where I just kind of hyper obsess over that, you know, something for a period of time. All of these things, you know, kind of built up. So when I was finally in video game, so I started working in video games as an artist, but I realized within a couple of years that it wasn't for me because it was still kind of around the 16-bit era, and creating art in 16-bit was less like creating art and more like busy work. It was, you know, you were placing dots, and it was hard. I found it hard to make things that looked artistic. I was very unsatisfied with some of the results. I wasn't. There are other artists, 16-bit artists that are amazing and have done amazing things with the, you know, like the people that do, you know, Metal Slug or Street Fighter or, you know, all those games. But I didn't have that talent. And so I very quickly realized that art wasn't really the best thing for me to be working in. But there were game designers, and I saw what the game designers were doing. Oh, the other thing was I went to school for art, but also I got a degree in filmmaking, and my emphasis was on screenwriting. So I also wanted to write, you know, movies and TV shows and things like that. So anyway, when I had this moment where I'm like, hey, I'd rather be doing game design than art, I made the switch. Fortunately, I had somebody to kind of mentor me, a fellow named Bill Anderson, who he took me under his wing and said, all right, you do my homework for me. Draw level maps and game design, you know, things like that. And I will teach you how to make games. And so thanks to him and kind of my desire to want to change professions, I ended up working on game designs. And then, like I said, about 2 or 3 years into it, I had that epiphany where I'm like, wait a second, everything that I've been doing has been priming me for this career mm-hmm. in game design. I didn't know it. I had no clue I was doing it, but I just happened to be fortunate enough to end up in a place that I now can use everything I knew how to do. Mm-hmm. And so all the things that I learned in school, all the things that I learned just by picking up, you know, absorbing, you know, the games that I played and the rules and the way that these things were created and being observant about how they are made, then I now had a fair amount of knowledge that I could use to be good at what I did. And I was also fortunate enough to work on really high profile titles. That's something else. I was happened to be in kind of the right place at the right time. And so I had these opportunities to work on Pac-Man World and to work on, you know, Miss Pac-Man and to work on Maximo and to work on God of War and all that. And so, you know, it's not just me. I'm not going to take credit for just myself making those games great because the whole teams were great. And they were super talented, and I was fortunate enough to have very talented collaborators and teammates. But I would like to think that I contributed a fair amount to those games and their success.
Awesome. Well, my instruments are starting to go back and forth. They're starting to say it's time to get down so we can hear more from Scott about his favorite stories. Let's go into our pre-launch, talk about games we played recently.
The pre-launch. Get to know us and our guest.
In the pre-launch, we talk about one game we played recently, and we share our feelings, our loves, maybe our hates about these games. Andrew, I want you to take this away and talk about games you've been playing recently.
Sure. So I recently discovered Shifting Stones from Game Right. It's a very simple and elegant design with art by Quan Che Moria, which, of course, I'm a fan of. But essentially what you're doing is you have a hand of cards, and those are your objectives you're trying to complete. You can use one of those objectives by turning it in, And then you can manipulate the board. You can either flip over a tile to another side, or you can swap two tiles next to each other. And essentially what you're doing is you're using some of the ones you don't want to turn in to qualify for the ones you do. And you get points for completing what you do. I think it's actually a really simple little elegant puzzle game. And I'm impressed. I think it's quite nice. So that's what I've been playing recently.
Yeah, that's a good one. It's been on my radar, and I'm also a Quan Chai fan. Hi, Quan Chai, if you're listening.
Yeah,
that's it. Looks like a good one.
And Quan Chai, if you're listening, we still want you on the podcast.
Yes.
Well, so. I will ask him for you if you'd
Perfect.
Like.
Perfect.
We've asked him once before.
He's shy.
He declined to come on because he was in the middle of a bunch of projects.
Yeah, he's also super. He's always super busy too. So
talent is always in demand. We understand.
Yep, absolutely.
Thanks. Well, speaking of talent and being in demand, let's talk about your game, Scott.
Well, yeah, Marvel Snap is it's a game I'm always playing. I have a love-hate relationship with that game. It is for those of you that don't know, it is a very simple little card game in which you are it's very similar to Star Wars Rivals, actually, if you've played that analog game, where you have a deck of 12 cards. Each of them have different abilities. Most of them have abilities. And then you're playing them down in one of three environments, which then the environments have their own abilities. Mm-hmm. So you're trying to maximize the effect of the card by playing it to a location. But sometimes the locations are negative or even unplayable, mm-hmm. which is a little annoying. It creates some interesting play space, but sometimes because of the randomization of the locations, you can end up getting screwed out of any sort of location where you can play anything good. And so they have the option for you to retreat. And that's where the other part of the strategy comes in, which is you have this, essentially it's like a backgammon cube doubler, mm-hmm. Where you can snap. That's where the snapping comes in. And then it will multiply the reward that you get if you win the game. And a lot of the strategy is, unfortunately, deciding when not to play, which is a bit of a bummer because having a game that, like, 30% of the time you don't play game sessions is dumb, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that's dumb is they have a couple of things that play the cards for you. And it's like, why am I playing the game when the card is being played for me? That's dumb also, right? So there's annoying design decisions like that. But also, there's some very interesting things. There's sometimes some very fun synergies that can be created between the cards. But my biggest problem with Marvel Snap is they have, you know, a pretty deep catalog of Marvel characters so far. Although I'm frustrated that they haven't hit Alpha Flight yet. Those are my favorite Marvel characters. But
that'd be so great. Sorry,
but
like Alpha Flight too.
It'd be fun, right? But the problem is that the cards thematically most of them don't synergize together. So, for example, they have the Fantastic Four. They have all four members of the Fantastic Four. All four of those characters do something completely different that really don't work well with the other characters. So they have Invisible Woman, you know, doing her thing, which is hiding the identity of cards. They have the Thing, which is he throws stuff to weaken cards. You have the Torch, who gets more powerful as he moves around. And you have Mr. Fantastic, who makes the adjacent locations, gives them points, which is just dumb because all four of them, they just don't work together. And it's the Fantastic Four. Right. They should work together, right? Like, there are other cards that, like for example, Iron Fist works great with the Human Torch. But that's not a good – why isn't Iron Fist work well with Power Man?
Right.
You know? Or you know, there's Spider-Man.
Preach.
Yeah. Spider-Girl works great with the Torch, or works great with Vulture. But why Vulture, right? The Vulture is a bad guy. He shouldn't work well with the one that works kind of the best, in my opinion, just because it's such a dumb spoiler one, is Dr. Octopus. Because he can either completely ruin or completely win the game for you. right? Like he essentially uses his tentacles to pull other cards out of the player's hand and place them down. So if you play them in a certain situation, like if Wong has the ability to double the abilities on a card, if you Dr. Octopus on Wong, it might completely F it up. But then it might also completely make it great for the other player, right? So that's typical Dr. Octopus. He's either a huge success or a huge failure. And so for me, I'm like, okay, that's, you know, I can live with that silliness, you know, it's, I'm okay with that. So it's, in the end, it's very addictive. It's very fun. It's, you know, if you aren't careful, you can actually spend money on it because there are lots of really cool variant cards that you can get. Mm-hmm. You know, there is a little bit of a pay to win, or at least they have like seasonal cards, new cards that come out and you pay like for the season and that gets you some of the new cards. And I've dropped some money on it and I don't regret it, but I'm trying to, I'm kind of going through a period where I'm like, nah, I'm not going to spend money on this game for a while. So, you know, unless Alpha Flight shows up, I don't need to spend any money on it. So that's Marvel Snap. It's a iOS game. You can play it on both your iPhone or, you know, whatever. I'm sure Android has it. And you can play it on Steam as well. If you like Marvel superheroes, it's a pretty cool little game.
I definitely did this as part of my research for game design, some games I'm working on, the lane battler aspect of things. And I really do think it's a little bit of a masterclass. Yes, it has some tweaking problems. And I think thematically, I think you hit on some brilliantly geeky issues that it has, but it's definitely worth exploring. But I also put myself in like a 1 month period. I'm like, I'm playing for a month and I'm done. So I'm happy to not pick it up again because I know how addictive it can be.
It's all the best things about Smash Up and all the worst things about Smash Up.
Yeah.
Right. So. Yeah. Smash Up is a little trickier in that I feel that Smash Up is a little too mathy for its own good. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's why when I played Rivals, Star Wars Rivals, I was like really pleased with it because I'm like, oh, they managed to capture that feel pretty well and without it end up being a big math game.
Excellent. Speaking of mathy games, I had the opportunity recently to play Grease Lightning. Grease Lightning from WizKids. This is a game where you are a bunch of mythological, I think, Argonauts on ships. You are racing around this really cool design of like a wedge of like basically racing around a circle of this wedge around the seas. And you're playing cards that are favorites of the gods. You're rolling dice. You're pushing your luck in order to try to go faster. And all the while, you're placing new wedges down in front of you in order to try to create the path you want. It's like a Suro-type racing game, but in a circle. And it didn't really strike a chord with me, to be completely honest. I think it might have been because we were playing at two players. Maybe it plays better with more players.
My guess is yes.
It's hard to get a two-player racing game down really good. So, I mean, it just didn't, it didn't excite me. Me and my wife played it. We ended up putting away early. But I will say this, production design is fantastic. Yeah. The wedges you're putting down, that part's really interesting. It just felt like the next 20 minutes I was going to play, it felt very samey. And I didn't want to spend my time with it. But I don't know, maybe it might be a lesson in me having to be more patient with games, but I just didn't have the time when I was playing it. I didn't want to commit to that much of it. So, I mean, this might be for some people who like the theme. The theme is good. The art production is great. Yeah. Everything about it is really good. It looks amazing. That's why I got it. But the gameplay just felt a little bit flat.
I was going to say, Josh, I think you bring up an interesting point about games, which is we are now in an era where there's kind of this embarrassment of riches. We have more games than we can play or have the time to play. And so, therefore, we're now treating board games a lot like apps. Which is we play them once, we go, it doesn't quite grab me. I'm going to just put it away and move on to the next one. And I don't know if that's a problem, a good thing or a bad thing. Because in the case of apps, I used to find myself churning through a lot of them. I would pick them up for either free or 99 cents. And play them and kind of go, oh, this is good, this is bad. But even the good ones, like Andrew, you know, was with Marvel Snap, is still something that he feels, you know, I can understand his feeling of going, I played it for a month and now I'm done with it, because he knows that there's other things that he can move on to, mm-hmm. that he's trying to get, you know, design lessons out of. And this is particularly dangerous, I think, for game designers, because we're just looking to absorb ideas and concepts and be able to add them to our utility belt of design. And so, like, you know, I myself have a very large shelf of opportunity staring at me. And I am like simultaneously looking forward to and dreading, but I also know that I'm going to be like only playing a lot of these things once, which makes me kind of sad and makes me kind of go, am I spending my time and money well on my collection? And I'm at a point now, I've got over 400 games, which probably doesn't sound like a lot to many people. For me, it's like unmanageable. And so now I'm like, all right, I need to trim down again. But B, I need to weigh, you know, what is worth keeping? What is worth hanging on to because of this, you know, what is sticky enough for me to come back to? And so it's a bit of a challenge, I think, for us gamers to deal with.
I think it's 100% embarrassment of riches, and I'm here for it, because I think the fact that we have so many great games means that you can find your next favorite. Yes, you have to attempt a bunch of things to get to that point, but I also am heavily a believer in there's a game out there for everybody, and you just have to find the one that works for you. So I'm okay with saying this game is not for me, and maybe I'll give it a second chance or I won't, and I'm okay with that, but I know it's for somebody else, and I'm glad that game exists for that other person. And my wife and I, I'm a butterfly player, so I like to touch everything, but she's a deep diver. So when she finds something you love, we're going to play that game 100 times. And I love that I have those games in our collection that we can go back to over and over and over and over again. But I also know that because there's 1,000 games coming out this year, I need to at least try maybe 100 of those, like just to get a taste of what's out there and find out what's new.
Yeah. And I would add to that, to anybody who is a game designer, who is like, I'm going to play all, you know, 100 games this year, which I think is admirable. Good luck trying to play 100 games this year, is that play some bad ones too,
yes.
Right? Like, because you can learn more, like Josh, I'm sure now learned some things about race games that, you know, he didn't know before, and he's forming an opinion and he's forming his taste of those types of games. Mm-hmm. And that's a good thing. That's something that every game designer should have, is taste, because that's going to inform the type of game that you're making.
Well, we are ready to go. My instruments are saying thumbs up, and there's no check engine lights, thank goodness. Let's go ahead and go deep down and dive into Scott's story.
I am fortunate enough to be able to own a copy of Kingdom Death Monster. It is a very expensive game.
Yeah.
It's not for everybody. It weighs a freaking ton. Literally, like physically, it's very heavy game to lift up. There's a lot to it. And if you don't like assembling miniatures, it is definitely not the game for you,
right?
Because the miniatures are quite complex. And then, you know, God forbid you start to paint them. Although there is some gorgeous, gorgeous artists out there who have done amazing things. You know, the big part of that culture is painting miniatures. Like it's a lot like the kind of the Warhammer crowd and that. I own this game because I had heard about it. I had heard how great it was. I was intrigued. The art, which is controversial to some people, it's very sexy. Mm-hmm. Doesn't bother me. I don't mind it. So I was like, all right, I'm all on board. Let's see if the hype is real. So I started playing it with a friend of mine. You know, we were playing a two-player game, and you play four characters in a two-player game usually. So we went through the first few sessions of playing. It's a boss battler. So you come across these bosses, you fight them, defeat them. You then plunder their body for parts, teeth and viscera and skin and things like that. And then you use those to craft weapons and items for your characters back at your settlement. And then you also make decisions about the settlement, how you want it to grow, what technologies you want to invest in. You try to procreate and create more characters, because you go through a lot of characters. This is don't get attached to your characters in this game, because they will die. and in horrible ways. It's got a bit of very old fashioned Dungeons and Dragons or other role playing games in it. I remember playing Traveler, and a friend of mine rolled up a character and only to have it die even before we started playing the game, which I always thought was hilarious. Right? I myself am old enough to think of those kind of things as hilarious. And I also like the roll on a chart and you're going to get some sort of random thing. It doesn't bother me. Randomization doesn't scare me. So we were playing this game and one of our characters became through application of like, where did I want to put the points, but then also a few lucky instances of things, the character became very powerful. Which is good. It's always good to have a very strong character because mostly the characters are pretty weak. And so this character was like actually capable of doing things and fighting and you know, helping defeat these bosses. So we're like, awesome. We've now got this female character. She's great. Let's take her out on all of our hunts and get these monsters. So a couple of things happened. First of all, we had this situation where the bosses are run off of a deck of AI cards. And the goal of the game, the boss fight, is to, as you do damage, you start to remove AI cards. And that's essentially their health, which is a really neat system. It kind of limits the character down. And then by the end of it, the monster is generally just kind of a rampaging brute, which, you know, makes things very tough for the characters to capture and fight. You know, fight. You don't capture them, you just kill them. But there was a moment where the creature was like a antelope, a screaming antelope is the name of it. And it was this horrible beast that would like run around and kind of charge into you and smack you and do all types of damage to you. And so every time we would get near, it would run away. And we're like, we can't kill this if it keeps running away. It's very frustrating. And I figured out that if we had a character go in one direction and another character go in the other direction, we could trick it to essentially kind of bounce off of one character and then run hopefully in the other direction where then we could, you know, jump on it and kill it. And we played it that way and it worked. And I'm like, I can't believe this is the first time I've actually felt like the AI of a character in a game has had, it's something that I could outwit. Right. And it made me feel like I was playing a video game. It was like, wow, this is really super cool that this moment happened. So that was part of this moment that was very exciting in this campaign. But the other thing that happened was, as kind of a result of this, the character, that super strong character, through some dice rolls, realized that they were like, well, I'm too powerful. I'm going to take over the tribe and I'm not going to go on hunts every turn, I'm going to go every other turn. So now this very powerful character was becoming kind of a prima donna, mm-hmm. and like leaving themselves out of the hunt. We're like, oh man, that's our best character. We can't use our best character every turn. That sucks. And then after we had the other team of characters go out and they came back with a successful hunt, the gal that was this had proclaimed herself leader got jealous of the other one who had done the kill and murdered her. So now she murdered her. And then she said, screw all you guys. I'm out of here, but I'm coming back every season and I'm going to fight you guys and I'm going to kill somebody. And so now we have this, we never got to this part of the game because unfortunately COVID hit and we had to stop playing, but we had this lingering threat of now this very powerful character that was going to come back and kick our asses. And we were like, what are we going to do? How are we going to deal with this? Right. So it created this whole really fascinating narrative that was just the result of dice rolls and a few choices from us. And I'd never experienced these things in a board game before. I'm like, I've experienced some role playing games, but never in a board game. And so that's why I love Kingdom Death Monster, and I hopefully will be able to get back to playing it now that lockdown is over. And I'm going through a health issue right now, so once I get through that, then I will be able to hopefully get back to it.
That's just really impressive story. And yeah, it's so interesting the way that sometimes things can organically evolve in a way that the game designers thought of, but didn't combo, right? Like, so right. They didn't think that combo could come into play, but they, they made a position where it could have. It's so cool to see that all work out that way. It's very interesting. And I know that Kingdom Death Monster has a very, very strong cult following. People who like that game love that game, and they'll bring it out anytime you ask them to. And there are people out there who don't like it at all, but that's okay. It goes back to my thing. There's a game for every person, and that game has a cult following because it resonates with some people.
Yeah, it's funny because there's a lot of games that are expensive, and I think that people say that they're great games because of the fact that they're expensive and they're trying to justify their purchase, right? They don't want to look foolish of saying, you know, hey, I invested in this expensive thing and it's not that good. But I'll tell you, man, Kingdom Death Monster is... it's expensive, but it delivers. It delivers in so many different ways. It delivers in gameplay. It delivers in the miniatures. It just the whole experience. I call it a Cadillac experience, right? Like it's this, you know, it's kind of like buying a big expensive car, but there's definitely, it's worth it. like Ferris Bueller says, if you have the means, I highly recommend it.
Right. And I don't have any empirical evidence of this, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was one of the impetuses behind, you know, Isaac Childress's Gloomhaven being what it is, right? Like, right. I'm not saying he took from it or anything like that, but I think that because Kingdom Death Monster exists, something like Gloomhaven could then come out of its own thing and blossom its own way
for
people who are also looking for something that's like that, but different. And because of that, it could then take off into stratospheres the way it did as well.
Right. Well, I jokingly say that Gloomhaven is, dungeon crawls for the Euro group, right?
Yes.
Like they're the people that don't like randomization, they don't like dice. And so Gloomhaven a card deck is just another randomizer, but it's a different enough experience. It doesn't feel like it has more input randomness than output randomness.
That's the randomness I prefer. So yes, totally agree.
Right. Yeah.
Something that's always astounded me about Kingdom Death. I've played Kingdom Death once before. I've just learned how to do the combat and I had a blast with it. But I just look at these games as a consumer and a designer. And I just think how do you even start something like that? Like I've started
making one.
Yeah. Like how do you start making a Kingdom Death monster? It's like, I have this idea. But then, it's always like, I have this idea, but I'm like, how do you encapsulate pretty much a a Genesis experience into a game?
I mean, I think that the Kingdom Death Monster and Gloomhaven are the products of people that maybe didn't know better, right? They just kept creating and creating and creating and creating, and it just became this huge, slightly unwieldy thing. But to both of, Isaac's and Adam's credit, they tested the hell out of it, right? Like they both really tested their games out and it took them years to develop them. And then, when they show up, these things are not overnight, things. They're not things that just pop up out of nowhere. And I remember Isaac showing up at a local convention in LA and with Gloomhaven 2 years before, Gloomhaven came out. So, these guys have been working on this for a while. And I think it, Josh, the answer is you just keep making.
Yep.
And you make and you make and you make and you make. And you could look at those games and go, look at the scope. How many cards do they come with? How many miniatures do they have? How many experiences do they allow for the player? And you could kind of build around that. That's a very mathematical way of dealing with it. You could say, Kingdom Death Monster has 6 boss fights, so I'm going to have 6 boss fights in my game. And so you could start that way, hanging some meat on your bones. But again, I think that the fact that these massive games, I think it's just they just kind of, people are just, it's their enthusiasm, I think, make them end up making them that big because they just kind of get out of control as designers. Right.
I think also it's a matter of that's where their passion was, right? Like, I think you start small, you take your bite-sized chunk, and maybe you created the combat, right? And then you start to create a world around the combat. You start to add on a little piece here and a little piece there. And then, of course, through iteration, you shape and evolve and shift, and you narrow back down and build back up in different ways. But I think as a designer, it's really up to you what scope you want to go at once it gets near the end product, right? I can always make it bigger. I can always make it smaller. And part of it is what my target audience wants or the game that I personally want to make. But I do think you can't look at it and say, I'm going to start from the overall picture of I'm going to make an entire world. You got to make a small section of the world and then build out from there. But I think it's really truly how much the designer wants to put into it, the time, the effort, and the passion.
And I think, Andrew, you also hit on the fact that these both of those creators had a lot of lore that they wanted to share, mm-hmm. right? They're both very story-heavy experiences, and they've created these very detailed worlds, very different worlds with their own rules. And then you apply those rules to gameplay. And you know, so things will start to kind of bubble up, and you go, oh, hey, this idea for something that I have would make for a cool encounter or make for a cool rule in the game or something like that. And so I think it's a combination of passion for this, trying to create this thing, but also having a lot of the ideas and creativity to pour into it.
So there's a ton of these type of games like Kingdom Death and Gloomhaven that have flooded through Kickstarter, these giant miniature, almost lifestyle games, mm-hmm. and lots of them come and go, in my opinion. They come, they make a splash, they was like, oh my gosh, these are great, and no one talks about them again. Kingdom Death and Gloomhaven, you know, Frosthaven now, the Gloomhaven universe, are still talked about and played at conventions today, and lots of these other ones fall by the wayside. So in your guys' opinion, as, you know, experienced designers, what makes these lifestyle games last, as opposed to just being pooped into the universe and never seen again?
I would chalk it up to they continue to create content. Both Gloomhaven does it in the sense that there's other, you know, there's Jaws of the Lion and Frosthaven. So they do it in the way that there's new product, but in the same universe, where Kingdom Death is still pumping out. Like, I have a set coming that should be in the mail that I ordered like 4 years ago, 5 years ago, but he's still making content, right, for the game. You know, more bosses, more experiences. He came out with this thing called a gambler's chest, which was literally like this advent calendar full of characters and experiences and cards and things like that. And it was massive, and it grew from what he originally thought it was going to be. And so he's going to keep creating content for years to come because that's his passion. He's got this universe. He's creating things for this universe. Every time he creates something, he's adding more story. And then Gloomhaven, you know, I'm sure is the same way. It's, you know, with each new iteration, I'm sure there'll be another, you know, Fire Haven or you know, some Rock Haven, I don't know, that Rock will Haven. Be, you know, a new iteration of the game, but in a new location or something like that. So as long as these creators are creating in this same universe, people will stay interested.
I also will add in, I think that it's the level of quality. I think it's the amount of detail and passion that flows into these designs from these designers' heads that I think either keeps it alive or lets it die. If the quality isn't there, it's going to naturally fall and taper off. But as long as they continue to hit the high milestones of quality, then people are going to continue to look for them.
So to kind of wrap up this experience with Kingdom Death and our conversation, Scott, you're a teacher. You've been teaching, you've been writing books. What creative lesson would you implore to our listeners based off of your experience when we talked about that? What creative lesson?
I would say that, the thing is, like Andrew said, you know, this game isn't for everybody and it isn't for every game designer to make, right? Like, do I have a Kingdom Death in me? Maybe. I don't know. You know, I like to think that I have something like that in me. You know, I've got a couple of ideas that I've been noodling around with and saying, would it be to the scale of that? I think it'd be fun to do a game of that kind of epic scale. But I also know that if I want to sell games, particularly the way that I do them, which is to publishers, I license, you know, games to publishers. That's not the game that they're looking for, mm-hmm. right? Particularly in the mass market. Like those, you know, Kingdom Death and Gloomhaven are mostly not mass market games. You know, Gloomhaven had to make this kind of abbreviated version of itself in order to be sold at mass market. But I don't know how well it did. You know, I still saw copies kind of lingering on the shelves. So I'm not sure if the audience was wanting to buy a $40, $50 game. You know, that's not really Target's, the target price for Target or Walmart buyers. But that said, if I was doing a Kickstarter, I would maybe try to do a game like that, because I think, like you said, those are the ones where people are the most excited. They get very excited over lots of miniatures and a big sprawling game with lots of parts to it. And to be honest, I like those games too, although I don't like how big they are on my shelf. I that's my biggest complaint, is if I were to make something big and sprawling, I would try to make it small and sprawling, you know, like at least in a tidy box the size of like Reagan's Rocket Ships or you know, Town Folk Tussle or something like that, or Nemesis, I guess. But the lesson that I would take away from the play experience is that you can create these, you can do a lot with just cards and words. And that's the magic of board games, is it's kind of amazing that there are games that can have those things happen. And there's, you know, I don't know if there's a lot of them. I can count on maybe one hand games that I've had kind of really cool synchronistic events happening, you know, where, you know, you draw a card and then you play something else and you play something else and they all kind of fit together. And that's really great. I love it when that happens. It's really hard to design for, because usually the amount of information that you have is so huge that the combinatrix of them, the way that they all combine, is too big. But as Andrew said, you can predict them. And this is something that I always want to emphasize for game designers, which is, no matter how big a game gets, everything is predictable if you know what the factors are. Mm-hmm. So the example that I like to give is a friend of mine, a fellow named Jeremiah Slaxa. He was the lead designer of a game called Scribblenauts. And Scribblenauts was a puzzle game where you would write a word or type a word, and it would create an object. And then if you combined it with another object, you could use it to solve a puzzle. So, for example, if there was a cop and you wanted to move the cop out of the way so you could get into a doorway, you could draw, like, you could write donut, and then that would lure the cop away. Mm. And the cop had several keywords, like donut was one of them. So if he saw a donut, he would like run over to where the donut was and eat it. If you typed out the word criminal and made a criminal appear, the cop would run out and fight it and try to arrest it, you know, things like that. So there were lots of keywords in each of these little characters, but there were literally like 65,000 keywords or 65,000 objects or something like that. It was like some obscenely huge number of things. And I went to him and I said, "Hey, Jeremiah, you know, if I wanted to make like a cougar and like, give it a flu and see if I could get it to sneeze, could that happen?" And he's like, "Well, you know, the word, if you make flu, that adds a keyword sneeze. And then if you apply that to a living thing, it would then make it sneeze. So yeah, it could very possibly happen." And he goes, "Although that's not something that I would immediately know or not, I'd have to go and reference." And so the point that Jeremiah was making was that even though you've got this huge number of things, you could, as a game designer, we can still figure it out, right? We know what all the variables are, so you can figure it out. Now, this goes into a thing that I'm going to get on my soapbox for a second, because there's a mentality that a lot of young game designers have, which is this idea of what's called emergent design, which is I'm just going to throw things together and a game will happen. And that's a misnomer. That's an impossibility. It's naive to think that that's going to even happen, because as a game designer, everything that we do is design. It's in the title, right? It's like we design everything. Just like when my students are making video games, the first thing they do, I talk about, you know, this again, you know, against the idea of emergent. There's no thing, nothing is emergence for a game designer. There is for a player. There's a big difference between the player's perception of emergence and what a game designer is doing when they're designing a game. But when my students are creating something, say, in like Unity or Unreal or something like that, I say, what's the first thing you guys do when you make a level? And they go like, well, we put the light in, right? So you can see what's going on. I'm like, yeah, you're like God. You know, in the Bible, it says, you know, God created, you know, first God appeared and then there was light, right? And it's like, and that's the game design. God is a game designer, right? Everything is designed. Everything is created. Now, whether you believe in God or not, that's a whole other thing. But the mythological concept of God in the Bible, he is a designer in the sense that everything was created. And game designers are the same way. You create everything. You should know what everything does, and therefore you should know what everything does when they are combined together. Mm-hmm. Now, can the system get so big that you lose track of it and you don't know, and because you haven't thought of it yet? Sure, absolutely. That's exactly what's happening in Kingdom Death and Gloomhaven and, you know, Betrayal at House on the Hill and lots of other games that have all these variables that can then create these fun synchronicities. And then the synchronicity is us as gamers having the perception to go, oh, there's a pattern here, because humans are always looking for patterns. Yep. And so when that happens for a game designer or for a player, they're like, wow, look at this cool thing that happened in the game. And meanwhile, the game designer is going, well, that's awesome. It happened. I didn't expect that, but cool. I'm glad it happened. You know, so there are these, as a game designer, you have to remember there's a different mode of thinking as a game designer than as a player. Now, it's good to put yourself in the shoes of the player, because that's, you're going to create a good experience for them. But you're not the player. You're the game designer. You have to remember that first. And then you can think about the player after you've done your diligence as a game designer.
Excellent words of wisdom. We are very deep down in the Kingdom Death Sea. There are sharp stones and lion testicles floating around. If you play Kingdom Death, you'll know exactly what that means. Let's go ahead and head into our sonar and see what games are in our future.
Well done, Josh. Well done.
Nice. I see that, Josh.
Thank you. On the sonar, we talk about one game we're looking forward to playing in the future and why we're looking forward to playing it. Let's go ahead and give Scott a break and bring this over to Andrew.
All right. So I heard about this game. It's interesting. It's called Far Away. It came out this year. This idea of exploration in a timeline where, like, you're stacking cards down a line and then you go down the line, you experience those things. This seems so interesting because I am, first of all, fascinated by exploration within a game in a limited environment, right? Like in a video game, you can explore an open world and you can go any direction, and that's so cool. And that's true exploration, because you're literally being able to go anywhere that was created by someone else. But in a board game or in a card game, there is a very limited set of resources, and how quickly will you get through them? And then will the next game even be exploring at that point? Because most of the time it's not. Right. So I'm very curious to see how this is all going to go. But I think it's about the combinational aspect of using those cards and going in lines can be interesting. But I have not yet tried this one. It's just one I'm very excited to find out about.
I like this art, Andrew. Yeah. I'm looking at the art right now. It looks fantastic.
What was the name again, Andrew?
Far Away.
Far Away. All right.
All one word.
Okay.
I will put it on my radar.
Speaking of which, Scott, what is also on your sonar? Because if I say radar, the boating community will get mad at me. What is,
right. Yes, exactly. What's
on your sonar?
So what's on my sonar is a game by my friend, a little humble brag, Jerry Hawthorne at Plaid Hat Games, which is called Wandering Galaxy.
Ah.
And Wandering Galaxy is the latest in his kind of storybook style game. If you've played Mice and Mystics or Stuffed Fables or what's their pirate one? I always forget the name of it. But anyway.
Forgotten Waters.
Thank you. So Wandering Galaxy is the latest in that series of type of games. And the way that it's been described is essentially it's like Guardians of the Galaxy, the board game. Which, you know, right there, I'm interested. You know, give me a ship full of ragtag characters going on space adventures. That's right up my alley. And I know Jerry is a very thoughtful and excellent game designer, so I've always enjoyed the games that he's created. So I'm really curious to see what he does with this. There's not a lot of details about it. There's a few images. I think it's coming to Kickstarter pretty soon. And so that's one that I'm looking forward to backing and then eventually playing.
Yeah. Anyone that taps into the Firefly storyline, I'm fully on board in. So I'm definitely checking this out as well.
And Jeremy, if you're listening, if you ever want to come on, talk more about games, well, please let us know. We'd love to have you on too. Just saying.
I can ask him if you want.
Please do.
He's a friend.
Please do. So. Thank you so much. Well, for me, I am looking forward to playing a game called Mythalex. Mythalex from Grand Gamers Guild. This is your kind of... It's basically Greek mythology battling each other game. You know, it has area majority. You're trying to build a deck. There's dice rolling. It doesn't look special. It has lots of great art in it. But it kind of looks like, oh, there's another Greek fantasy game. But I am excited to play it for one. It's from Grand Gamers Guild. I tend to trust Mark Spector and what the games he puts out. I think he puts out pretty good quality games for his publisher. And plus, you know, it does have art that does appeal to me. I do like James Church. James Churchill is one of the artists. There's a couple other artists. David Lopez. There's actually a bunch of them. But it has that kind of unique style that I like. So there's some things that attract me, and I want to give it a shot for those reasons. And plus, I got it for free because it was from Tantrum Con, and they gave it to me because I was there. So, but that is Mythalex from Grand Gamers Guild.
How do you spell that?
MYTH, like myth, and then ALIX.
Mythalex. All right, cool. I'm checking it out now.
Excellent.
Nice.
Well, we've kept you down here long enough. We're almost out of oxygen. Scott, let's shoot up back to the surface, and we'll let you on the shore.
Okay, thanks. Don't go too fast, or we'll all get the bends.
Yeah. I've had the bends for 2.5 years.
Oh.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I absolutely enjoyed just getting a fire hose of wisdom from you. Yes. People want more Scott Rogers in their life. They want to support you. What can they do?
Besides enrolling, you know.
So I'm pretty easy to find in social media. If you put in Scott Rogers Game Designer, I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Facebook, usually under Mighty Bedbug or Scott Rogers. Really the best things, is to purchase my books. You can, you know, Level Up, The Guide to Great Video Game Design, Swipe This, The Guide to Great Touchscreen Design, or the latest, Your Turn, The Guide to Great Tabletop Game Design. But if you do buy these books and you enjoy them, please leave a review, because this is it helps authors greatly, particularly when it comes to algorithms on these types of websites where you can buy these books. And then otherwise, if you're interested in my games, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the board game from Trick or Treat Studios is out. You can still buy Pantone the Game on the Cryptozoic Entertainment website. You can purchase Alien, I think, is, I don't know if it's out of print in the U.S., but I think it's still available on Amazon and a few other, and, you know, your favorite gaming store, as well as I did two Villainous expansions, the Venom, We Are Venom, and the Doctor, I did Dr. Octopus in the Twisted Ambitions expansions. So those are still available for purchase. And if you ever see me at a convention, I will happily sign your copies of games or books or whatever. Oh, and you can see me in Game Master, the documentary from 2000.
Well, most excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on. As always, my name is Josh.
And I'm Andrew.
Oh, and I'm Scott.
And this has been the Tabletop Submarine.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to support the Tabletop Submarine podcast, please consider giving us 5 stars on iTunes and share this podcast with your friends, family, and other gamers in your life. See you on the next voyage.